All right, good morning. Bio 241, this is May 5th, is that right? Yeah, May 5th, Tuesday. All right, so we got three more lectures, two lectures this week, and then we have a lecture on Tuesday of next week, and then your final is I think 2 weeks from today. All right, so it's on a Tuesday, and we can review the syllabus to find out what time it is, but basically it's in 2 weeks, so you get a lot of time to study. What was I going to mention? Oh, there's something that I always forget. And that is, you guys have been kind of lucky this semester because you've had an SI session. And for fall semester, I'm still looking for SI leaders to carry on that tradition. So if anybody's interested in being an SI leader, you should contact me or contact Juan or contact Gil Contreras, because he's the director of special educational services, including SI, and see if you'd be interested in that. There's a lot of materials that you can use to run SI sessions, and I'm sure Juan would be more than happy to loan you his materials that you could modify, throw out, use, whatever, okay? So, and from previous instructors as well. You know, and everybody likes their own kind of notes, so would be helpful just to kind of look and see what everybody's done and kind of make your own schedule. So if you're at all interested, talk to me or Juan about that, okay? And the good thing is that it's a paid position, all right? So you get paid for doing that. I don't know how much, but the SI leader also goes to the lectures just to make sure that they're in tune with what's happening in lecture. And Juan, you get paid for that too. You get paid for coming to lectures. So you know what? If you're thinking that maybe your understanding of physiology is just a little bit shaky and maybe you would like to attend lecture again, guess what? You can, and you can get paid for it if you're an SI instructor. So how cool is that? That's pretty cool. So you might want to just think about that. Okay. So we were talking about respiratory system. We talked about the components, I believe, the function of the respiratory system. And a lot of times, we talk about the structural and functional unit of something, okay? And for instance, what's the structural and functional unit of life? The cell. Very good. Structural and functional unit of contraction is the, I like sarcomere, whoever said sarcomere, fantastic, that's what it is. And let's see, we talked about the structural and functional unit of information exchange between cells. What's that called? That's a synapse, right? All right, so if you're understanding that, that's nice because you're thinking the way I'm thinking. That's good because I make the tests up. So that's really nice. All right, so let's talk about the structural and functional unit of exchange of respiratory gases between your body and the atmosphere. And you should know what that is. What is that? That is the alveolus inside the lung. So that's a little spherical shaped structure. It is microscopic. You need a microscope to see it. And that's what I have a picture of right here on the slide. And you have 300 million of these alveoli. And they're surrounded by capillaries. All right, so gases inside the alveoli that come from the air when we breathe in diffuse across the walls of the alveolus and into a capillary by diffusion. So movement of respiratory gases is just passive. There is no active transport. So when I say passive, what does that mean? What does that mean? It requires no energy, but more importantly, which way do molecules have to move, or which is the only way they can move? Only from high concentration to low concentration. All right, so if oxygen is moving from the air into mitochondria, where is the lowest concentration of oxygen? In the air or mitochondria? Nobody wants to take a stab at that. Where's the lowest oxygen concentration? In mitochondria, right? Otherwise, oxygen wouldn't move into them. So it's kind of a little counterintuitive. Right, they need oxygen to make ATP, but oxygen wouldn't go there unless that's the lowest concentration. Okay, the same thing for CO2. CO2 leaves our body. What organelle produces CO2? Oh, help me, I'm forgetting. What organelle makes CO2? mitochondria. What's the metabolic pathway that makes CO2 inside mitochondria? It's the Krebs cycle. Yeah, don't forget about any of that important kind of stuff. And again, how does CO2 leave our body? The same way oxygen enters is by what's that process called? Starts with a capital D. Diffusion. It just leaves by diffusion. So where is carbon dioxide highest?
Inside
your body in the mitochondria, and it diffuses to the outside world, and the outside world carbon dioxide is basically zero concentration. All right, and so there's a big concentration gradient that's moving CO2 out of your body. Indeed. Okay, so that's how movement of these respiratory gases takes place. All right, and it happens in this alveolus right here. So capillaries form a network around the alveolus, but there's something else around an alveolus as well. Besides the capillary network, there is a network of elastic proteins, elastic fibers. What can you tell me about elastic fibers as opposed to collagen? If you pull on collagen, what happens? You know, not really much because it's really strong. When you pull on one end of a collagen, the other end comes right along with it. It's like a steel cable, right? It gives your body a lot of strength. What about an elastic fiber? It stretches, and when you let go, what happens? It goes back to its original condition, and it can actually pull things together with that elasticity. Okay, and reticular fibers was another kind of fiber that you learned in anatomy. Those are really weak. If you pull on those, they just rip apart, right? They're very, very weak. They don't stretch, and they're used only when you have extremely mild tensions placed on an organ, for instance, like the spleen. Okay, so around this alveolus, you have a lot of elastic tissue. And so when an alveolus expands, when you breathe in, guess what happens when you relax your muscles? Those elastic fibers contract the alveolus and you exhale that air that's inside the alveolus. So that's what's really important about that elastic tissue. I'll mention it again. All right, the other parts of the alveolus right here is that what kind of cell makes an alveolus? Here I see the nucleus right here. What kind of cell does that look like to you? And here's another one. These two cells, yeah, they're flat because what kind of tissue lines a cavity or covers the surface? That is an epithelium, right? An epithelium lines a cavity, covers the surface. And so here's a special kind of surface that's specialized for exchange. So what kind of epithelium is used for exchange? Could it be a stratified squamous? No, way too thick. All right, what about columnar? No, way too thick. Whether it's simple or stratified, wouldn't matter, way too thick. All right, so the one that's specialized for exchange is a simple squamous epithelium, and that's the kind of cell that's an alveolar type 1 cell that makes the wall of the alveolus. Okay. There's an alveolar type 2 cell inside the alveolus and a macrophage. This macrophage, remember, was a monocyte. It's a white kind of white blood cell. It's produced by red bone marrow. It crawls out of your circulatory system and is crawling. You have millions crawling around all over your body, looking for dust particles that end up in the alveolus, swine flu virus, whatever shouldn't be in there, right? This macrophage is going to try to phagocytize and then destroy to keep you healthy. Now, the alveolar type 2 cell is there for a completely different function. It's not there for structure necessarily, but it's secreting something. All right, so let's consider the situation that is being dealt with the type 2 cell. Is water a sticky molecule or slippery molecule? Okay, so I hear both. Maybe I heard sticky more than everything else. And it's kind of both. Yeah, like if there's a puddle of water, right, on a linoleum floor and you step in it, you might slip. Okay, but at a molecular level, all right, water is very sticky. Why do water molecules like to stick together? Because they're polar molecules and they can form hydrogen bonds between each other, right? Two hydrogen bonds or spheres of hydrogen bonds. So water molecules stick together, so water really acts like a glue. And that's what we have inside this alveolus right here. Now these are very thin cells. They're very compliant. An alveolus can collapse right? Because that all those elastic fibers are trying to squish it down, and if this side of an alveolus touched this side over here, because there's water inside an alveolus, you know what? It would never be able to expand again. So maybe you have done this experiment at home, or maybe it has happened by accident. If you have a little saucer that's dry and you put another saucer on top of it and then just grab the top saucer and try to lift it off, can you lift it off, the bottom one, if it's dry? Okay, actually I need to bring some saucers in. And the answer is, yeah, you can. Okay, but now what happens if the bottom one is wet? And you put the top one on top of the wet one and then just pull on the top one, what happens? They're glued together, right? And that's because of the polar bonds between all those water molecules, right? It produces something we call surface tension, and you can't just, it would almost be impossible to pull those dishes apart without breaking them. The only way you could separate them probably is by sliding them off of each other, okay? And that's how you could separate. So try that at home. But we're going to try that in class, right here. Oh, I don't have, no volunteers in the front row. There's next to the front row, which is the second row. So here I have two transparencies, all right? And if I put them together, are they stuck together? They're just transparencies. So if I let go of one, what happens? It just falls. Like, do you believe me? If I have you pull on the bottom one, what happens? It just falls apart. It's very easy. Now, let's put some glue on there. What can I use for glue? Water. All right, so here's some water. I think we have water today. Yeah, here's some water. All right, so here I'm putting some glue on this one. Okay. Plop this other one down on there. So now I'm holding both of them. And if I let go of one of them, if I let go of the bottom one, is it going to fall away? Okay, just like that. So they're glued together. So what's gluing them together?
Water.
Just water, because of the surface tension on water. Go ahead, pull the bottom one. A lot of force. I tried to lift you out of your seat, but I couldn't quite do it. It came apart. Okay. So these things get stuck together just because of surface tension in water. Well, that would be really bad, because if an alveolus collapsed and you could never inflate again, you would suffocate. So the type 2 alveolar cell secretes something that disturbs the surface tension, and it's like a lipid. It's kind of like maybe a detergent or a soap. It's very slippery, and so the alveolus can inflate as a result of that. So the type 2 cell secretes surfactant that allows the alveolus to inflate. Okay, and these type 2 cells don't mature, don't become active until maybe just a couple of days before parturition, when somebody is being born. All right, so if there's a premature baby, that's always one thing that's on the top of our mind. Right, if somebody's being born, especially by a cesarean section, these type 2 cells aren't mature secreting surfactant, so these premature babies are experiencing what? Yeah, they have difficulty breathing. We call that respiratory distress. All right, so their lungs don't inflate because all the alveoli are kind of glued together. And these cells don't mature until the fetus experiences some stress. And usually just the stress of being born is enough to activate them. But if they're born by cesarean section, there's not, and that's really usually premature, without a stressful delivery, these cells don't become activated. So how do we treat somebody in respiratory distress? Give them oxygen, yeah, maybe put them in an oxygen tent, right? So that's what we see in that kind of ward in the hospital, all those little babies in oxygen tents, until their lungs develop and the alveoli inflate. All right, so don't forget about that function of that type 2 alveolar cell. So right on the surface of the cell that makes up the wall of the alveolus, you have a layer you have the endothelium, but right on top of the endothelium, you have that layer of surfactant so that the alveolus doesn't collapse. Okay. All right, so there is a membrane that we like to think about that oxygen has to move across, or carbon dioxide has to move across in the other way. We call that the respiratory membrane, and it's got four components to it. Your book mentions three, but I want you to add one thing to it. So what are the layers that a molecule of oxygen has to move across as it goes from air in the alveolus into the blood in this capillary? It's got to move across that layer of surfactant. It's got to move through the wall of the alveolus. It's got to move through this very thin interstitial space, right? So that you could consider this like a basement membrane, a very thin basement membrane. And then it has to move through the wall of the capillary. And what can you tell me about the cells that make up a capillary? What's their shape? They're specialized for exchange, so they're a squamous cell, right? It's an endothelium. It's an epithelium that's lining a blood vessel. It's just a simple squamous epithelium. All right, so that's the wall. That's the respiratory membrane, those four components. I'll say it again really fast. You've got the layer of surfactant, wall of the alveolus, interstitial space, wall of the capillary, and then that molecule is inside your body as a result of that. All right, so know those things and the order of that. Okay. All right, so the size and shape of an alveolus allows for exchange. Now, I told you that we have 300 million of these alveoli in your lungs. That's a huge number. And consider each one of those maybe an apple or an orange. And an apple and an orange, you can peel. All right, you can peel the skin off, and then you have the skin, the outside surface of that grape or orange or apple, and you can lay it flat on a table. And then you can take another apple and peel it and put it next to the one that the first one that you did, and then you could figure out how many apples you would need to cover the whole table, okay? So that would be the surface area of all those apples. And how would we consider, what is the surface area of this table right here? It is the width times the length. That would be the surface area of this table. All right, so here is the door. What's the surface area of this door? Did we measure this last time? Yeah, we did, which is what? 2 square meters, right? It was 1 by 2, all right? All right, and we then talked about when we say surface area for exchange, what's the everyday word that you should have in your mind that you could use to think about surface area and exchange? Surface area really means what? A doorway, right, for exchange. And the bigger the doorway, the more exchange you have happening. All right, so if we were to take all 300 million alveoli, what would be the size of the doorway? Did I tell you that? Yeah, half of a tennis court. Good, okay. I don't know if you know that from another class or if I told you that. Okay. So it's 70 square meters. It's half of a tennis court. So that's a huge surface area, and that surface area is due to the shape of the alveolus. Okay. So that's why we say the alveolus is the structural and functional unit of exchange in the lungs, because it is so huge. Okay. All right, this is all just some anatomy that I think I'm not really going to talk about. Oh, all right, that's good. Okay, physical, let's talk about ventilation. This is moving air in and out of your lungs. How do you move air in and out of your lungs? All right, results from pressure changes induced by changes in lung volume. So you change the volume of your thoracic cavity, and that causes pressure changes. That's basically how we breathe in and out, right? And air is a fluid, so it's going to move if some kind of force is applied to it. So what kind of force do you need to move a fluid? You need pressure, right? So a fluid will move from high pressure to low pressure. So when air moves in your lungs, what's the pressure inside your thoracic cavity? Is it high or low compared to atmospheric pressure? It's got to be lower, otherwise air wouldn't move in, all right? And when air moves out, what's the pressure inside your chest? That's got to be higher, right? And that forces air out, right? So that's how fluid moves in and out of your lungs, namely air. So the lungs have compliance. That means when there's a change in pressure, there's a change in volume. It changes volume very easily. There is elasticity. What would you use to tell me about elasticity of an alveolus? Do you have elastic fibers where? Around every single alveolus if you have a normal, healthy lung. And don't forget, skeletal muscles have elasticity. There's an elastic component in skeletal muscles, and you have a bunch of skeletal muscles around your chest. Okay? And so all of these things influence ventilation. All right, so the membrane that surrounds the lungs is a serous membrane. How many divisions does a serous membrane have? It's got 3 parts to it, right? So there is a division that's right on the surface of the lung. What part, how do we call that membrane that's right on the surface of an internal organ? What do we call that division of a serous membrane? That's a visceral division, all right? And then there's one on the body wall. Maybe you can see the colors of these things, but I really can't, all right? The other division is right on the thoracic wall. That is what we call the parietal division of a serous membrane, and you have a space between them, okay? And that space contains serous fluid. Now, this serous fluid is a lot different than the fluid that's inside an alveolus. This fluid does not have surfactant in it. It's nothing making surfactant in the pleural cavity. So, what can you tell me about that material in the pleural cavity right here? Is it slippery or is it sticky? What the experiment we just did. The serous fluid is just like water, which is sticky, all right? So it acts like glue. So that serous fluid is gluing what to what? It's gluing the wall of the thorax to the surface of the lungs, all right? So that's another way that our lungs expand, because as we breathe in, we expand our thoracic cage, and when the thoracic cage expands, it's actually pulling on the surface of the lung because of what? Because of that serous fluid in the pleural cavity, because it's sticky. Just like the experiment we did right here. Okay, so that helps lung expansion as well. All right, so know those divisions. That space contains the intrapleural pressure. Okay, and the intrapulmonary pressure is the pressure inside the lungs, and we're measuring this in millimeters of mercury. All right, notice that the intrapleural pressure, which is the pressure in the serous cavity, or the pleural cavity, is always what? The same as the intrapulmonary pressure, greater than or less than? It is always less than, right? So again, that's just evidence that what? That space is holding the surface of the lung to the thoracic wall. If it was higher, then it would be doing what? It would be compressing the lungs, but it's always lower. So it's helping to attach the surface of the lungs to the thoracic cavity wall. Okay. So here is an important rule that you should know. This is Boyle's law, and it relates pressure to volume. And how is pressure related to volume? This is just a law of the universe that happens everywhere. It's inversely related to each other. So if pressure goes up, what happens to volume? It goes down, right? Because it's inversely related. If it was directly related to each other, then they would both go up together, right? All right, so let me say it the other way. If the volume increases, what happens to pressure? The pressure decreases. All right, so that's how you decrease pressure inside your lungs, okay, is by increasing volume. If you increase volume, what happens to pressure inside your lungs? It goes down compared to atmospheric pressure. And if your lungs have lower pressure than the air, which way does air move? It goes from high to low, so it goes from the air into your lungs. That's how you breathe in. All right, and then as you breathe out, the volume of your lungs shrink. What happens to the pressure? If volume goes down, what happens to pressure? It goes up, and now the pressure inside your lungs is higher than the atmospheric pressure, and if your nose is open and your mouth is open, air will leave, okay? But if you close your nose and close your mouth and you pressurize your chest, what happens? Well, your eyeballs pop out. Anybody listening there? A couple people. Okay. So that's how you breathe, right? Just by changes in volume. So you have some muscles. Where are these muscles at? Well, I'm going to tell you. Where are the muscles at? Mechanics of breathing. Here are some muscles. Okay. So there are basically two ways that we breathe. There's what we call quiet breathing, and there's something called forced breathing. So forced breathing is what happens when you're hyperventilating. Quiet breathing is like what you're doing right now. You're just normally breathing in without any kind of exertion. All right, so for inspiration, we need some muscles for quiet breathing. Let's talk about quiet breathing first. The most important is the diaphragm. It is this dome-shaped structure right here. And when it contracts, guess what happens to it? It flattens out. So it becomes flat. So this whole area where the cursor is moving in now, That volume is added to the volume of the thoracic cavity. All right, so when the diaphragm contracts, what happens to the volume of the thorax? Does it go up or down? The volume goes up. What happens to pressure? It goes down because of Boyle's law. When pressure goes down, what happens to air? It goes into your lungs. It gets sucked into your lungs as a result of that. Okay, so that's a very important muscle. Some others that you might use for quiet breathing are the external intercostals. The external intercostals are between the ribs. All right, so when you inspire, the diaphragm increases your thoracic cavity by moving inferiorly. The external intercostals lift the ribs up laterally, but also anteriorly as well. So your rib cage expands laterally and anteriorly, increasing the volume. So if that increases volume, what happens to pressure inside your chest? Goes down, stays the same in atmospheric pressure, so air goes into your lungs for inspiration. All right, so those are the two most important for inspiration, external intercostals and diaphragm. Okay. Now don't forget, the diaphragm has elastic tissue in it. So that when you relax the diaphragm, guess what happens to it? It goes back to its original location, right? From being flat to being dome-shaped. So what happens to the volume of the thorax then? As the diaphragm goes back to its normal location, it decreases. What happens to pressure? Increases. It increases above atmospheric pressure. So what happens to air in your lungs? As long as your eyeballs don't pop out. It leaves, right? It just flows through your nose and mouth to the outside world, right? And the same thing with these external intercostals. They just relax, right? Now, what other part of the lung is elastic besides the diaphragm that goes back to its original location? Yeah, all of the alveoli as well, right? So that when the diaphragm relaxes and forces air out of your lungs, all those alveoli do what? They shrink back down to their normal size. That helps pressurize the alveoli. That helps expel air as well. Okay, so for quiet breathing, you exhale passively, just by relaxation. You don't need any muscle effort to exhale for quiet breathing. As long as the alveoli are normal, they have the right amount of elastic tissue around them, and that the diaphragm is normal as well. Okay? Usually we don't find too much pathology in the diaphragm, but there are disease states where people lose elastic proteins around the alveolus, and guess what they have trouble doing? They can breathe in just fine, they just can't breathe out. Right? And if you can't breathe out, what does that mean? Then that means that, well, then you can't really breathe in if you got no place to put air because your lungs are full, so you're in respiratory distress as a result of that. Okay? Okay, so that's quiet breathing. So, here I have a couple models. Let's think about an alveolus, and we could model an alveolus one of two ways. It could be this paper bag right here, or it could be this balloon. Right? And which one do you think an alveolus could be modeled by better? Okay, so here we have an alveolus. We're going to contract the diaphragm. What's going to happen to this alveolus right here when we contract the diaphragm? It's going to do what? Yeah, it's going to inflate. Okay, so let's inflate. Let's pretend. Okay, I don't have anything to pull on, so I'm going to have to inflate by just blowing into the bag. All right, so I trap that air in there. Okay, so I got the air trapped in there. Did you all see it expand? Okay, that was pretty easy to do. All right, now I'm going to let go of the air that I have trapped inside this bag right here. What's going to happen to it? Is it going to leave? Okay, and tell me if that's a good example of an alveolus. Ready? Pretty boring. Not much happened. Why is that? Because it's not elastic. Yeah, it has no elastic properties. Okay, now what about this balloon right here? See if this is a better model of an alveolus. So let's blow the balloon up. Hopefully it won't pop in my face here. Ah, that's good. Okay, so here's an alveolus that's been expanded now. Okay, oops, sorry. And, okay, so now let's just passively let go of the balloon. What's going to happen to that air inside the balloon? Is it going to be stuck inside the balloon or is it going to be expelled? Whoa! Okay. Sorry about that. All right, so is that a better... I get it later. Is that a better model of an alveolus or the plastic bag? The balloon is much better if it's a healthy alveolus, right? If it's not healthy, okay, respiratory distress. Huh? Pop it? No, because I want to use it next semester. Oh, no, that's okay. I can pop it. Today's Cinco de Mayo. I'm going to stop on the way home and get another bag. Just kidding. Okay, so that's for what? Quiet breathing. Quiet breathing. So what's the other kind of breathing? Forced breathing. That's when you're hyperventilating. All right, so don't forget, for inspiration, it's active. You need muscles. For expiration, it's passive. But for forced breathing, you need muscles for both. So for inspiration, for sure, you need the diaphragm. You need the external intercostals. But you also need some other muscles for inspiration, like the sternocleidomastoid and the scalenes, because they elevate ribs 1 and 2, and that acts as an insertion point for the external intercostals, and that helps raise the ribs laterally and anteriorly. That further increases the volume of the thoracic cavity, further doing what to pressure? Decreasing pressure, and that increases the flow into the lungs as a result. Okay, so scalenes and sternocleidomastoid, in addition, when forced breathing is occurring. And now, since you're breathing rapidly and deeply, the elastic tissue is not enough to move the air out of your lungs, so you need to employ some skeletal muscles to get air out of your lungs. And the muscles that are used are your stomach muscles. So the stomach muscles compress abdominal contents up into the diaphragm, which compresses the lungs, and that helps expel air. So give me some examples of anterior muscles in your stomach, anterior abdominal muscles. Rectus abdominis, that's everybody's favorite, but don't forget about what the transverse abdominis, the internal oblique, and the external oblique all work together in forced expiration. Okay, and some people that are in chronic respiratory distress, like people with emphysema, patients with emphysema, they have trouble moving air out of their lungs, all right, so they have trouble breathing. So they have to use a lot of muscles every time they take a breath. And when you see them, they have, what happens if you use a muscle all the time? It hypertrophies, it gets bigger and stronger. All right, and you can just tell by looking at them if somebody has emphysema or not, because they have big, strong muscles all around their chest. They're barrel-shaped, right, because they need those muscles to force air in and out of their lungs. All right, so under normal circumstances, quiet breathing requires no muscles, but if you have trouble expiring, you need to develop some muscles to help expire air. Okay. All right, so I think I've covered things I want to talk about here. All right, so we're moving air in and out of our lungs, so the amount of air will change depending on the state of health of our lungs. And maybe some of you have had family members that have surgery in a hospital and they're recovering from surgery. And one of the complications of surgery is pneumonia. What's pneumonia? It just is an infection of your lungs, right? There's an irritation of your lungs, and it has a tendency to fill up with fluid. And if it fills up with fluid, then you don't have air going in those alveoli. And, of course, that makes you sick just for that reason alone. So after surgery, we like to exercise somebody's lungs, and there's a little device called a spirometer, right? And you exercise your lungs by inhaling as deeply as you can, and that expands your lungs, keeps your lungs healthy, it keeps pneumonia from developing, it keeps fluid from building up inside your lungs. So a spirometer is a device that can be used to measure respiratory volumes, or what we call pulmonary volume. So here's a chart. Here's a chart right here. This is an exam figure. Okay, so you'll have to be able to label this chart. Here's a chart that has lung volume kind of versus time during respirations or during breathing. And you can see that the total lung capacity in an average kind of person is about 5.7 liters. Not quite 6 liters, but about 5.7 liters. And you see some very small deviations up and down, starting at about 2,500, to maybe 2,700. The absolute numbers are not so important for you to realize, but at least the little deviations of these lines right here you should recognize. And this represents, these small lines right here, just represent the amount of air that you're breathing in and out of your lungs when you're breathing quietly, right? The normal quiet respiration. And so the air moving in and out of your lungs, we call that the tidal volume. Right now, I think what's really important for you to appreciate is, where is that tidal volume? Where is this line bouncing up and down? Is it bouncing up and down right at the top of your lung volume? Is it bouncing up and down right at the bottom of your lung volume? Or where is it? It's right smack in the middle. All right, so what does that mean? Well, that just means that at the end of a normal expiration, at the end of a normal tidal volume when you breathe out, what can you do? If I breathe out normally, I can even force more air out of my lungs by what? Compressing my internal intercostals, by compressing the abdominal muscles. So additional muscles that can be used to help compress the rib cage down are the internal intercostals. What are the external intercostals for? Raising the ribs out. So they're good for inspiration. External intercostals for inspiration, internal intercostals for expiration. All right, so by contracting abdominal muscles and internal intercostals, you can force more air out of your lungs. So this volume right here is what we call the expiratory reserve volume. It's always there in reserve. It can be used if you ever start to exercise, for instance, or maybe play a wind instrument or sing or something like that. Okay. All right, there's another volume too. Since tidal volume is in the middle range of your total lung capacity, right, at the end of a normal inspiration, what can you do? You can take a really deep breath and fill your lungs up as much as possible, and that volume right there is what we call the inspiratory reserve volume. So the inspiratory reserve and expiratory reserve volumes are there to allow you to change your activity level from being quiet, sedentary, to exercising, right, without losing consciousness, because you need to ventilate more to get more oxygen in your body when you're exercising. Okay, so if we put expiratory reserve and inspiratory reserve and tidal volumes together, all three of these volumes, we get something called the vital capacity. That's the amount of air that you consciously can move in and out of your lungs, right, if you try really, really hard. All right, so a capacity in the lungs is the sum of a couple basic volumes. So a capacity is a combination of volumes. A volume is just a standalone item, like tidal volume, expiratory reserve. And if we put a couple of these volumes together, we get a capacity. And vital capacity is inspiratory plus expiratory plus tidal volumes. So all of those are volumes together. All right, so that is what allows you to function, is that vital capacity, and change your activity level. There is some air inside the lungs that's always stuck in there, we can never get out, and we call that the residual volume, right? Because the bronchi have cartilage, they're held open all the time, and the alveolus never completely collapses, so there's always some residual volume in all those 300 million alveoli and those tiny bronchi as well that can never escape your lungs. So if you put vital capacity together with residual volume, you get the total lung capacity. Right, so those are the ones that I'm interested in. I'm not so interested in you memorizing functional residual capacity or inspiratory capacity, but the ones that we just talked about you should be able to label. Okay, so that's easy on the test. All right, so what happens to somebody when they have asthma? Or, for instance, when they have emphysema or other kinds of degenerative lung disorders? So asthma can be produced by allergies, for instance, and emphysema. What's the most common cause for emphysema? Smoking. Yeah, smoking is, unfortunately. That's a degenerative disease where the alveoli get destroyed and the small air passages get destroyed. And what happens is people have a hard time exhaling, and so this tidal volume that you see moving up and down right in the middle of your total lung capacity, right? As lung disease progresses, this tidal volume moves up higher and higher in the total lung capacity chart. All right, and then finally, right in the end stages of emphysema, the tidal volume is way up near your total lung capacity. So what can you tell me about somebody's reserve volumes? They're gone. They're completely used up, right? So they cannot exercise. They're in respiratory distress. And then what happens when somebody's tidal volume gets shrunk down because this residual volume gets so big that you don't even have enough room to ventilate anymore? What happens then? Well, then you need to breathe oxygen. Okay, that helps for a little while. Or else you need a lung transplant. Okay, so, and of course that happens to people. All right, so this tidal volume just moves up and up and up, and then finally there's no any longer room for it to move up, and then you need a lung transplant as a result of that. All right, so spirometry is really important for us to understand the normal functioning of lungs. All right, so let's talk about some factors affecting gas exchange. And gas exchange, we said, is just due to a change in pressure. It's almost like concentration, okay? Like things move by diffusion from high concentration to low concentration. Gases will move according to pressure, from high pressure to low pressure. And when you have a mixture of gases, for instance, like in the air that we're breathing, that's just not oxygen, okay, we can, just like when we mix up a solution and figure out what the concentration is of the various solvents and solutes, we measure the partial pressure of each of the compounds that contribute to gas in the air that we're breathing. We call that partial pressure. So the gases that make up our atmosphere pretty much are nitrogen and oxygen and CO2, and then there's some water vapor. Right, and that P right there stands for the partial pressure of each of these gases. And if we add that all up together, the normal atmospheric pressure is about 760 millimeters of mercury. Okay. Okay. And so gases will diffuse by partial pressure. All right. So in inspired air, depending on the humidity of the air that we're breathing, the partial pressure of water can change. If you're out in the desert, it's basically going to be zero. If you're in a very humid area, then the partial pressure could be a lot higher, maybe 100 millimeters of mercury. All right, CO2 is basically what? 0.3 millimeters of mercury in the air that we're breathing in. Oxygen is 159, and nitrogen is, what, by far the largest component of the air that we breathe, and nitrogen is pretty much inert in our bodies. It doesn't affect us one way or the other. But CO2 does, and oxygen does, and water does to some extent. So if we were to add all these up, that would be, what, normal atmospheric pressure. But as we breathe in, what happens to the air? It becomes humidified, right? So now water becomes about 47 millimeters of mercury. And what is our body producing? A lot of CO2. So CO2 diffuses into the alveolus, and that raises the partial pressure to 40. Oxygen goes down. Why does oxygen go down? Because it's being absorbed by capillaries. And nitrogen pretty much stays the same. Okay, it doesn't change very much, but the partial pressure is going to be pretty much right at atmospheric pressure right at the end of inspiration. Okay, so these partial pressures do change. All right, so here's a pretty good picture of an alveolar sac that has all these alveoli. Here's an alveolus, but in your book, what are you missing? You see a capillary right here, but what are you missing on this diagram? Something that's very important for normal, quiet expiration that you have in your anatomy books, which is really nice. So your anatomy books are better for anatomy than the physiology book. That's all there's to it. And what's missing right here is the elastic network, the elastic proteins surrounding this alveolus right here. Okay. But this is pretty good because at least it shows all the capillaries. Okay. Okay, so don't forget that the heart is basically two pumps, and you have two circulations. They're back-to-back. We call that in series with each other. What are those two circulations again? The systemic circulation and the pulmonary circulation. So the amount of blood flowing through the systemic circulation has to flow through the pulmonary. So what can you tell me about the flows between the pulmonary and the systemic circulation? They have to be the same. Otherwise, blood is going to build up someplace, right? All right, so it has to be the same. But although it's at a much lower pressure in the pulmonary circulation, and that's because the resistance is a lot lower, so therefore it doesn't need as much force. Therefore, the right ventricle is very weak compared to the left ventricle. Okay. Okay. Pulmonary arterioles constrict where alveolar PO2 is low and dilate where it's high. All right, so there is a matching of ventilation, which is basically ventilation is controlling oxygen inside the alveolus with how much blood is going to that particular alveolus to absorb that oxygen. And we call that the ventilation perfusion ratio. So ventilation is what? Moving air in and out of the alveolus. Perfusion is not air, but perfusion is blood flow to that particular alveolus. Perfusion is blood flow. So let's contrast this with the systemic circulation. Okay. So in general, what's one kind of rule that you should be familiar with already between the systemic circulation and pulmonary circulation? Are they exactly the same, or are they different in some respects? They're different? Like how different? What was one way to think about the difference? Okay. In the systemic circulation, the arteries are oxygenated, but in the pulmonary circulation, arteries are deoxygenated. Yeah, that's a fantastic example. That's the one that there's other examples that you might be thinking of that are really good to think of. And then the corollary to that is that veins in the systemic circulations are low in oxygen, and veins in the pulmonary circulation are high in oxygen. Okay, so in the pulmonary circulation, why are arteries low in oxygen? Because they're going to the lungs to pick up oxygen. That's the whole job. Okay, and systemic arteries are high in oxygen because they're delivering oxygen to the tissues, right? All right, so here we have an arteriole. So here's an arteriole, and then coming off this arteriole, what does this look like to you? And then here is a vein, going back to the heart, right? Artery, leaving the heart, vein bringing blood back to the heart. All right, these arterioles have smooth muscle around them, so they can constrict and dilate. What does that do? That changes flow through this tube. Capillaries, what's at the entrance to a capillary? You have a precapillary sphincter. They can constrict and dilate, and when it constricts, what happens to blood flow through this capillary? Yeah, it decreases, right, because of Poiseuille's equation. So you've got to be familiar with that. All right, so when does this precapillary sphincter does not have innervation. It's not under extrinsic control. It's under intrinsic control. And intrinsic control means what? A property of the muscle itself. So this muscle regulates itself. It relaxes. When do you think that, and so this is systemic, let's say systemic circulation. When does this precapillary sphincter relax? When oxygen is high or when oxygen is low? Okay. So this would be systemic circulation. Give me an organ in your systemic circulation. Liver, okay. Give me another one. Kidney, okay, that's not bad. Here's kidney. Give me another one. Okay, spleen. Okay, I'm going to pick something. Kidneys are really active, all right, but so is your brain, right? So is what? Skeletal muscle? So is skeletal muscle part of your systemic circulation? No? You don't know? Yeah, it is. Okay. So, as oxygen decreases, what does skeletal muscle need more of? It needs more oxygen. So what should happen to this precapillary sphincter? It should dilate. Yeah, it should open up. It should dilate, right? So when there is decreased oxygen in this capillary bed, that means that this muscle needs more oxygen to make ATP. This causes vaso what? Vasodilation. All right, and if it vasodilates, what happens to blood flow? That increases blood flow to this capillary bed so that the muscle can stay healthy. Right? So that's systemic circulation. All right, so now what do you know about the comparison between the systemic circulation and pulmonary circulation, generally speaking? It kind of is opposite to each other. All right, so let's take a look at that. So here's systemic circulation, here's pulmonary circulation. Here you have that alveolus with capillaries around the alveolus, right? You got capillaries all around it. And then here is an arteriole feeding blood to this capillary, and you got smooth muscle around this arteriole with blood going into it. And now let's just say that you have low oxygen in this alveolus, right? What's going to happen to these smooth muscles right here? Is there a reason for this blood to go to this alveolus when it doesn't have oxygen in it? What's the purpose of blood going to an alveolus? To pick up oxygen. Okay, so here's an alveolus that doesn't have oxygen. Can you see that this is going to cause vasoconstriction? Which is what? The opposite effect that you had over here in the systemic circulation. All right, let's just say you have another part of the lung that has an alveolus, but now it has high oxygen. And you have blood, and that blood can either go here, or it can go here, but there's smooth muscles here. Where is blood going to go? Is it going to go to the alveolus with low oxygen or to the alveolus with high oxygen? Well, because the purpose of that blood is to pick up oxygen, it's going to go to the one that has high oxygen. So what's going to happen to these smooth muscles? They're going to dilate. All right, so can you see that the pulmonary control is a lot different than systemic control? It's got to be opposite to each other. And so that's what we call local control. And this is what matches, this mechanism right here, matches perfusion of blood of these alveoli to ventilation. When you're ventilating a lot, there's high oxygen. That's the part of the lung that's going to receive the blood so that it can be oxygenated. The less functional parts of the lung that are low in oxygen won't receive blood because there's no reason for blood to go there. Okay? Now, here's an interesting thing that I can relate to a little electrophysiology lab that you did where you measured the mean electrical axis of the heart. This is sort of an interesting exercise you can do in your mind. Okay? So, when there is low O2 in the lung, that means that's going to cause vasoconstriction. And let's just say that's everywhere in your lungs. Maybe you stop breathing for a little period of time. Oxygen decreases in your lungs. This causes, what does it cause? Vasoconstriction. All right, so blood stops flowing through your lungs. What happens to pressure as you increase resistance to flow, right? When you constrict, that increases resistance. What happens to pressure? It increases, remember? Because pressure is equal to what? Stroke volume times heart rate times resistance. So if resistance increases, the pressure increases, and we're talking what circulation? Pulmonary circulation right here. All right, so now we have pulmonary hypertension. And so the heart has to work harder to pump blood into that high pressure circuit because of that vasoconstriction right there in the lungs. Right? How does the right ventricle respond to that when it has to work harder? How would any muscle respond? Yeah, it would hypertrophy. It would get bigger and stronger. And what's going to happen to the mean electrical axis of the heart as the right ventricle gets bigger and stronger? It's going to shift to the right. All right. And as a matter of fact, there's really no easy way to measure pulmonary hypertension because you have no blood vessels on the surface of your body like you do systemic arteries and things like that. It's easy to measure systemic blood pressure, right, with just a pressure cuff, but you can't put like a pressure cuff around somebody's neck or something. But you don't even have any pulmonary circulation in your neck. It's where? All deep inside your chest. You can't get that, those arteries. So as the right ventricle gets bigger and stronger to deal with that pulmonary hypertension, okay, that the right side of the heart is going to fail, just like the systemic side of the heart is going to fail with chronic hypertension. Right, and it's difficult to measure, but with the mean electrical axis of the heart, you can see pulmonary hypertension. So it's a really easy way of doing it without opening up somebody's chest and actually measuring that pressure or getting an echocardiogram. Okay, but here's the interesting thing and the reason why I mention it. So you get pulmonary hypertension, when what happens? When you're not ventilating properly. Do you know any people that don't ventilate properly? When is a very common case when people stop breathing or stop ventilating? Like, for instance, sleep apnea. Yeah, that was on the tip of my tongue, actually. Okay, so when people sleep, if they have sleep apnea, they stop breathing when they're asleep, and then they kind of wake up, right, and start breathing again, fall asleep, stop breathing, and what do? All night long. Wake up, start breathing, fall asleep, stop breathing again. All right, so that really is really obnoxious. All right, but what's the really bad thing? When you're underventilating, you stop perfusing your lungs, okay, and what does it produce? That produces pulmonary hypertension. And eventually, if it goes untreated for a number of years, depending on the severity, what's that going to do to the heart? It's going to kill the heart, right? And somebody that has sleep apnea, if they have an advanced case of pulmonary hypertension, they might end up needing both a heart and lung transplant. All right, so that's just something we don't normally think about when you kind of think of sleep apnea as being a nuisance kind of disease, but it could be end up being very, very serious because it produces that failure of the right side and the high pressure in the lungs, which kills the lungs. So it's a very serious kind of disease. All right, so could you follow that discussion a little bit? Yeah? Okay. Yeah, so if you know somebody with sleep apnea, you know, try to support them and try to help them get treatment for that because it could be a fatal disease, right? It's just not something that is a little bit obnoxious. Okay. All right, let's talk about control of ventilation. Okay. The brainstem contains the respiratory center. And so here's the brainstem, here's the medulla oblongata, and then here is the pons, right? There are a number of centers. I don't think I'm going to ask you to know what the individual centers are and what they do for respiration, but you should know that the respiratory control center is right here. And what can you tell me about your breathing even though you're not thinking about it? What happens to breathing? Well, you breathe in and you breathe out. It's what? Rhythmic, right? So is there another organ you know that's kind of rhythmic, autorhythmic on its own? Like the heart, right? There's a pacemaker in the heart. Okay, and so there's like a pacemaker also in the brainstem, part of the respiratory center, that triggers respiration, but of course it can adjust itself depending on the needs of your body. All right, so that's inside this respiratory center. And, you know, people can get strokes of their brain or cerebellum. You can get strokes within the brainstem, and if it affects your respiratory center, guess what? You're going to have trouble breathing automatically without your conscious thought. And as a matter of fact, there are some people that when they inspire, it is only the result of a conscious effort on their part. It will never happen automatically because the respiratory center is damaged. So you can imagine what that would be like if every breath that you take, you have to voluntarily want, like picking up a pencil or something. All right, so what happens when you fall asleep? Well, you need to be on a ventilator because you're not consciously thinking about breathing anymore. And that's called Odin's curse, when you have to consciously think about every breath that you're taking. So that's a lesion in this respiratory center right here. Okay. All right, so those centers stimulate inspiratory neurons that innervate respiratory muscles. And what's the most important inspiratory muscle? That's the diaphragm. And can you remember what muscle goes to the diaphragm? I don't have it on any of your lists right here. What nerve goes to the diaphragm? Then probably you should know where it comes from. What's the origin of this nerve? It is the phrenic nerve. Okay, it's the phrenic nerve. And where does the phrenic nerve originate? Well, where's your diaphragm? Way down over here. Okay, what's the origin of the phrenic nerve? It's way up over here in your neck. See, and how do you know that? Because there's a little funny saying, you could say. C3, 4, and 5 keeps you alive. And then it goes through the cervical plexus. So if there's damage to any of those particular origins of the phrenic nerve, you can still get signals to the diaphragm, and you can still breathe as a result of that. So C3, 4, and 5 form the phrenic nerve that goes all the way to the diaphragm for inspiration. Okay. All right, but more importantly, let's talk about a response loop. All right, that helps regulate inspiration. And the integration center is the respiratory center in the medulla. And what does the respiratory center have? And a response loop, what do we call that center? The general name for that center. That is the integration center. And what does an integration center have? It's got a set point, okay? Now we have to figure out what it is that the set point is looking at. So if you're going to control ventilation, what kind of molecules might you want to look at inside your body to see if they're adjusted properly or not? Oxygen would be my primary guess. What might be another one? Yeah, CO2 would be pretty good, right? Because your body produces CO2. Could anybody think of maybe one more? I didn't quite hear. Okay. I did hear pH, and pH is real important as well. So let's just think about those three compounds, oxygen, CO2, and pH. All right. And you might be wondering, well, why pH? But can you remember how pH is related to CO2? How is pH related to CO2? There's an enzyme. That's a hint. All right, I'm erasing our systemic circulation right here. All right, so we're going to start with CO2, which is produced by Krebs cycle in the mitochondria, right? All right, CO2 then can be interconverted into another compound. This is a two-way street because the free energy change is almost nil. What can it be interconverted to? Oh, you know what? I got to put a water. Can I put a water right here? Is that easy? Yeah, because we've got a lot of water in our bodies, right? All right, so CO2 and water can make H2CO3. What is that? That is carbonic acid. What's the enzyme responsible for that? That happens naturally without an enzyme, but an enzyme does what? It speeds it up so that it happens in our lifetime. What's that enzyme called? All right, carbonic anhydrase. Got to go back and look at all those different enzymes. Okay. And then carbonic acid, because it's an acid, it dissociates very quickly into hydrogen ions and what else? Bicarbonate ion plus HCO3, and that's an anion. All right, so you can see that hydrogen ion is directly related to carbon dioxide concentration. If you increase carbon dioxide concentration, you increase hydrogen ion concentration. What happens to pH then? It goes down. Okay, because remember, as the hydrogen ion concentration goes up, it becomes more acidic, but the pH scale goes the opposite way. Okay, so the pH goes down as a result. So pH and carbon dioxide concentration are almost the same variable because of carbonic anhydrase. Okay, so in our bodies, we want to be looking at carbon dioxide. We want to be looking at hydrogen ions and oxygen as well. What kind of receptors do you need to measure chemicals in your body? You need, chemoreceptors, right? You need chemoreceptors. Okay, so you have two locations for chemoreceptors. There is a central location and a peripheral location. All right, so what does peripheral nervous system mean to you? Means, like in the extremities of your body. What is central nervous system? Brain and spinal cord. So the same thing for these receptors, right? So central means inside your brain. Peripheral means outside your central nervous system. So the central receptors are in the respiratory center, which is where? In the medulla. And the peripheral receptors are in the arch of the aorta. So you have the aortic bodies. And then you have some other chemoreceptors in the carotid sinus. We call those the carotid bodies. And so where's that carotid sinus at? Yeah, it's right at the bifurcation of the internal and external carotid. And it's coming from the common carotid. So it's right at that bifurcation. There's a little bulb right there. Okay, so you got these two kinds of receptors, the central receptors and the peripheral receptors. The central receptors are very important because they can monitor CO2 and pH. And the peripheral receptors are sensitive to oxygen. All right, so there's a little bit of difference right there. All right, so which one do you think might be more important? Let's talk about that. Okay, so as CO2 increases, right, chemoreceptors modify ventilation to maintain normal CO2, oxygen, and pH. Right, the partial pressure of carbon dioxide is crucial because of its effect on blood pH because of, what's the name of this enzyme again? Carbonic anhydrase. So hyperventilation causes hypocapnia or low CO2. Hypoventilation causes high CO2 or hypercapnia, which is going to affect pH. All right, so if somebody is hyperventilating, let's take a look at that. If somebody's hyperventilating, what does that mean in terms of ventilation rate? It's high. So your body is losing a lot of CO2. Why would that affect the pH of your body? Because as you lose CO2, it comes out. How is this chemical reaction going to react to that? And what's that law called? What's going to happen to bicarbonate and hydrogen ion as a result? Okay, if we lose a lot of CO2, then hydrogen ion will combine with bicarbonate, form carbonic acid, and then that's going to dissociate into carbon dioxide, and you're going to exhale that when you're hyperventilating. So when you're hyperventilating, you're losing hydrogen ion. What is that called when you lose hydrogen ion? Is that acidosis or alkalosis? Alkalosis. So when you hyperventilate, that causes a respiratory alkalosis that changes your blood pH when that happens. Okay? All right, and that's due to that carbonic anhydrase reaction. All right, so the most important molecule for controlling ventilatory rate is CO2, or you could think of it as hydrogen ion. They're basically the same kind of molecule because they're related to each other. All right, so decreased ventilation increases arterial concentration of CO2. That's a partial pressure of carbon dioxide. So that goes into the plasma. All right, that carbon dioxide can go into the brain. It diffuses through plasma membranes, no problem. All right, and when it does, it decreases the pH of interstitial fluid in the brain. Right, so CO2 in your blood can go right into your brain across the cell membranes, across the blood-brain barrier. Carbonic anhydrase then converts it into hydrogen ions. That decreases the pH. That stimulates the chemoreceptors in the medulla oblongata, then compares that to a set point, makes a decision to increase action potentials that go to respiratory muscles to increase ventilation. Right? So the drive for inspiration really is controlled mostly by CO2 that you have in the blood, not by oxygen concentration, which is kind of strange. I always thought that was strange when I learned that, right? It's not oxygen. It is actually CO2. Okay. And so as you lose CO2, what happens to... So then the CO2, partial pressure of CO2 decreases in your blood because you're ventilating more, and that feeds back, that subtracts from the initial stimulus, right? So that's a nice negative feedback mechanism. All right, so CO2 concentration controls your urgency to breathe, the feeling that you need to take a breath. All right, and as a matter of fact, when you start to exercise, what happens to CO2 concentration in your blood when you start to exercise muscles? It increases, right, because those mitochondria are using up oxygen producing CO2. All right, so when you start exercising, what happens to your urgency to breathe? Does it decrease or increase? Increases because CO2 is going up, the pH of your brain is going down, that stimulates the respiratory center and then respiratory muscles to increase ventilation to bring that back to normal. Okay. All right, so brain chemoreceptors, the central receptors responsible for the greatest effects on ventilation. Now, hydrogen ion can't cross the blood-brain barrier because it's polar. And the blood-brain barrier only can allow nonpolar materials to pass through it. But don't forget, CO2 can pass through cell membranes, no problem. And when it gets into the brain, it gets converted into hydrogen ion, and that's what stimulates the respiratory center. Right? And so the respiratory center adjusts ventilation to maintain an arterial partial pressure of CO2 of about 40 millimeters of mercury. That's a healthy concentration of CO2 in your blood. Okay. The peripheral chemoreceptors really don't respond to carbon dioxide, right? Only to hydrogen ion levels and also to oxygen concentration. Now, where were those peripheral receptors located at? The arch of the aorta and the carotid sinus right here. Okay. All right. Oh, here's a nice diagram that shows how carbon dioxide affects the pH of the brain. So here you have CO2 in a capillary. Okay, it's picked up CO2 from tissues, like skeletal muscles. Here's a blood-brain barrier. Remember, hydrogen ions cannot cross the blood-brain barrier, but what about CO2? No problem. It can get into cerebrospinal fluid, and it can combine with water to form, what is that? That is carbonic acid. What allows that to happen quickly? Carbonic anhydrase, and then carbonic acid dissociates into bicarbonate and hydrogen ions. As hydrogen ions then stimulate the chemoreceptor neurons in the respiratory center, which increase ventilation. All right, so that's kind of a nice scheme right there. Okay, so low blood oxygen or hypoxemia has little effect on ventilation. So is the PO2, the partial pressure of oxygen, decreases. We call that hypoxemia, decrease in oxygen concentration of the blood. Doesn't do much to increase ventilation, right? Contrary to what many people's initial impression would be. All right, but these are important, for instance, if somebody's body becomes extremely hypoxic. Under extreme conditions of hypoxia, then the oxygen receptors in the aortic and carotid bodies can stimulate ventilatory drive. And so we call that hypoxic drive, right, when somebody is really starving for oxygen. So here's a graph that just shows ventilation versus the concentration of oxygen on the bottom and CO2 on the top. And you can see that CO2 is this dark line and then oxygen is this blue line right down over here. All right, as oxygen and carbon dioxide change, which line, right, starts to move first? And which one moves in a much greater amount compared to the other? It is CO2. So you can see in this region right here, CO2 really is control of ventilation and not oxygen, because oxygen basically is kind of a flat line. All right, so oxygen concentration can change, all right, quite a bit, can double from 8% to 16%, okay, and it's not going to have any effect on ventilation. But in that same region, look at how changes in CO2 can drastically change ventilation, right? It can go from 10 up to 60 within that same range, while oxygen really doesn't affect ventilation whatsoever. All right, so CO2 is the most important thing. There's a reflex that's important that you should know about. That's the Herring-Brewer reflex. Lung tissue is fairly delicate, right? And it just has some elastic fibers that are holding the alveoli together. So the alveoli can expand too much, and they can rip, and they can become damaged. There are stretch receptors in the lungs. And as these stretch receptors stretch, they increase the number of action potentials to the respiratory center. And when they reach a certain point, those stretch receptors can inhibit further inspiration of the lungs or further expansion of the lungs so that the lungs don't rip. Right? So the Herring-Brewer reflex, right, prevents overinflation of the lungs. When you try to take a deep breath, right, you maximize out because of the Herring-Brewer reflex. They prevent overinflation of the lungs. All right, so I guess that's where I'm going to stop, and remind me to start with hemoglobin next time. Okay, hemoglobin.